Well, hello. Welcome to second edition of Office Hours here. And I'm joined by beloved friend of the channel, Pharaoh. How are you doing, Pharaoh?
Very well, thank you. And just glad to be on with the new format, enjoying it very much. So thank you.
Now, hold on a second. There's a guy in the chat who I've banned literally 100 times. He is being banned for 101st time. It's for life, mate. There's just no way in. So anyway, yeah, I'm a couple of weeks into the new schedule here, Pharaoh. 3 weeks in.
Yeah, still tweaking the times.
The channel, well, the times are set in stone now, because really? At 5 a.m, I thought I'd drop it in the most inconspicuous time. the new channel intro went up, and the channel intro has got the brand new schedule, which I might as well share for the benefit of people who didn't watch the channel intro, essentially. Let me see if I can find it a second. But it's gone it's come in stages, the revamp, but I think I finally got the final formula down. You know, the logo, the fucking thumbnails, Pharaoh. The font.
It was almost like a fever dream on Twitter. Just I'd logged in and seen about 4 hours of thumbnail based content as you were furiously tweaking it to achieve perfection. Have you achieved thumbnail perfection now, do you think?
Well, I don't know about perfection, Pharaoh. I think what I've come to is a settlement. Okay. First of all, I had the agonizing artistic struggle of doing this at all, because I despise YouTube thumbnail game, right? But then once I moved through the 7 stages of grief and came to an acceptance that I was doing it, I was then like, well, I might as well get the formula right and get it right once forever. I'm a little bit like that with clothes, because I hate shopping. I hate trying on clothes. And I'm also slightly colorblind, as some people know. So once various combinations are established, I'm like, right, I'm sticking with this. This is it now for like the foreseeable future.
I think men do tend to shop in that way. I always kind of, if I find like a pair of trousers or, you know, like a staple that I like, I'll buy 5 or 6 versions of that and just wear through them for the next 5 years or so. So.
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, I found that I really like Marks and Spencers for trousers and shorts.
Yeah,
and the shorts I've got are literally falling apart at the moment. they're fraying at the edges and so on. And so people have been asking me, like, well, what do you want for? It was my birthday recently. What do you want for your birthday? And I was like, well, shorts, Marks and Sparks, this waist size.
Nice.
Make sure it's this style, you know, and because I know they work, it's tried and tested, you know.
Well, I was just gonna say was that I've reached that time of life now where receiving a pair of socks for birthdays and Christmas is actually a genuine blessing. I'm genuinely happy to see them. So,
yeah, I've been there for a while, you know. It was my birthday recently, I literally got like a pair of shoes. You know, I'm going to get some shorts. What else did I get? Some cheese and some cheese biscuits and a cigar. And that was it.
That's a good haul.
And I even let AAA blow the candle out of my cake.
Oh.
So, you know.
You softy.
That said, it was a very good cake. It had buttercream on it, not vanilla. So I was happy with that.
Very nice.
Now, in terms of the schedule, I might as well share this for people who missed it. This is final now. This is final. This is not going to change again. 8 a.m. every morning, you get a short. which I've been putting out. I've started making shorts again, Pharaoh. YouTube keep on bugging me to make shorts. And when I don't make them, they're like, why didn't you make shorts? The shorts were going well. Why did you stop making them, type of thing?
I really love the idea. There's that YouTube manager rep in the London office and whatever. He knows who you are and he's having to kind of check through all of your content and be like, oh, you know, how do we... We need AA to make more shorts. Contact him now. You'll get invited to the offices soon at this rate, you know.
No, I'm invited to the offices all the time, Pharaoh. All the time. I never actually go.
It'd be so funny. You should do like a seat hidden camera kind of thing, just like speaking to the manager.
Meet the creators and all this sort of stuff. I'd rather not. I can even book the studio out, which I've never done, but you can do that as well. But
yeah,
anyway, 8 a.m. is the shorts, and basically that's going to be filmed badly by me, probably smoking a cigar when I can. I film them all in a go, like 10 of them at once, and then, you know, set them to upload. So 8 a.m. is a short. And in fact, one of the things I'm going to do, and people will have to keep on reminding me of this, but somebody said, for example, they'd like to see a short on what does counter signaling mean, right? Well, I can do that. Because I had 59 points, Pharaoh, and I've run out of them, basically. Do you remember I gave that talk ages ago?
Yes,
59 points. All of the shorts were basically one of those. Oh, shit. Well, one of those. Basically, I've run out of them now. Well, once this batch of shorts is done, I don't know what. I've got one idea. What is counter signaling? So if people want something addressed that can be addressed in 1 minute, you can send me some suggestions, basically, and I'll keep a short list. So far, I've got one on the short list, counter signal. Then every day, 9 a.m., books on Mondays, British news on Tuesdays, American stuff on Wednesdays, international affairs on Thursdays, something more fun and cultural on Fridays. So, for example, yesterday there was that thing on woke imperialism. Today there was that thing on Keir Starmer. Tomorrow there's Trump eating bloody Haitian dogs or Haitians eating dogs video. Thursday, I'm talking about, what is Thursday this week? I can't remember now. Thursday is Russia versus NATO, unrestricted warfare. And then Friday, I'm probably going to do something on the Dandy and the Beano. Unless my carry-on film makes 10,000, in which case I might do a second carry-on thing because I've got tons of... I've got bloody books of carry-on facts. I've got lots of carry-on related content that I don't know. I
want to know what the no reason. I want to know what the foreword was from Phil Collins. That sounded fascinating. Like, why was he?
Phil Collins was a massive carry-on fan, according to his foreword. He so loved funny. Watching those films growing up, and they were an inspiration to Genesis and all the rest of it. Go on, Pharaoh, go on.
I was just gonna say, I've got a concept for the shorts. Why don't you do little biographies of famous writers like Burnham or Evola or whatever, just a short saying who they
yes,
are.
Yes, or a book recommendation. It was another also suggestion.
Good, yeah. That's good, yeah.
Book. Yeah, read this book or read that book. I could do that very easily. In fact, I might do. That's a really easy idea. I could do that. I could just sit down with a stack of books and be like, read this one, etc.
What's in your library? Yeah, that's good. The forbidden section.
Maybe not those ones. those, in fact, to be fair, those probably aren't the best books to read anyway. So,
yeah.
There's one of the forbidden texts that I recommend everybody read by a certain car manufacturer. Not everything is reliable info in there, but there's some very good and eye-opening stuff that is covered in that particular forbidden text. Then Wednesday mornings, Deepest Law, 11 a.m., me and Simon Roberts, and 2 p.m., the show you're watching now, is Office Hours. That is the schedule. And it's not going to change now for the foreseeable future. Which in our terms is what, like 3 months or something. We'll see. But that is basically the schedule for now. In terms of the rebranding, Pharaoh, I know you're a marketing guy, and it's been interesting because, of course, you know, many people in the audience are resistant to change, right? And I know, for example, that Vince McMahon always faced this, like, resistance from the crowd, resistance from the fans. And they always said, like, from a wrestling booker's point of view, you basically just have to, like, be like, yeah, well, this is the way it's going to be now. You're going to learn to love it, type thing. It happened when John Cena was the champion. I remember the fans were like, well, what the fuck is this? And he was like, no, you're going to stick with it. And he stuck with Cena for champion for like 5 years. And now people accept that John Cena is part of wrestling lore and is a kind of great ambassador of the company and this sort of stuff. But it took a while. But I've made several bold changes, you know.
This is kind of like Tone's point in one of your videos about speaking of the car manufacturer, about making not what the public want, but what they kind of need almost, which they don't even know they need.
They don't even know that they need it. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. This is the basic idea. You don't even know that you wanted it. So yes, basically putting some of these Elite Theory principles into practice, learned from Bernays and Vince McMahon and Tony Blair. But also, maybe in years to time, people will say like, oh, you know, we've come to love the corporate logo and the icy impersonal style that AA has gone with in this. or they'll be like, oh, I remember the thin white Duke era. That was when AA was all corporate. I will see. But anyway, just before we get going, Pharaoh, anything you'd like to promote, sir?
Yes, two things. Firstly, the classic Foundations of Entrepreneurship. I had a guy come up to me at the Witten to say he had gone through it all and how much he enjoyed it and thought it was really interesting. So check that out. I think it's a great value for the money. Also, if you've been watching the Simon Roberts Deepest Law stuff, it's really interesting because, especially with the last episode on PR, certainly for like one part of my course, there's like a huge crossover in terms of like choosing audience, like what we call today choosing audiences, and some of the profiling. You know, for example, you know, there were, one of my favorite moments was the two women just like judging people as they went by, categorizing them with a mosaic score. You know, yes. They were just like commenting and saying, oh, that person's a C1 or a C2. Basically,
I'd love to do that. You know how Dustin has been going out and like meeting real members of the public and trying to measure their skulls and stuff.
Okay.
Now, obviously I would never dream of wanting to speak to members of the public, but I think it'd be fun if me and you went out and filmed ourselves just doing what those two women were doing.
Just
try and categorize people by A1, A2, you know, C1, B1, P2. And we'd have to invent new categories for...
Yeah, it was even more brutal as well because they were sort of like just trying to understand about their entire lives just by how they look. But it's at the same time, there is truthfulness to that. You can tell a lot about someone just how they look. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly you can tell which category a woman belongs to based on what she's wearing. There's that kind of skin tight kind of ass hanging out thing that a certain of a woman... certain class of woman is doing at the moment, the long eyelashes and the fish lips, right? Well,
that's my people now in Essex. So
where are they? Be C1s? They're C1s.
No, but there's an interesting thing though, because again, historically they would be classed as like C2, like maybe C1s, kind of like aspirational middle class. But because basically the entire economy is so messed up right now, you know, a lot of them are making some very good money. So traditional middle class, like traditional Victorian middle class, is actually more broke than, you know, the these traditional working class, depending on the job they had. You know, I would say that, you know, middle management jobs pay less than being an electrician in London, for example. Or
you've got this bizarre thing of people being quite snooty, drinking their organic orange juice, but actually being broke.
Yeah,
100%. And then the kind of yobbish loads of money plumber next door, you know, with his 87-inch fucking 100-inch widescreen TV, you know, loads of money. They're now next door neighbors. In some ways, the positions have been reversed in terms of who has the money.
Yeah, like I'm not sure if they're next door neighbors, because I think there are still kind of like tribal elements to it in terms of how people cluster together. But for example, if you were to compare the average salaries of your traditional Victorian middle class people who are living in Hackney to those who are living at the end of the central line in Epping, say, I guarantee the people in Epping will be on like 40% more salary, 100%, even though they come from working class backgrounds. So
interesting. Very interesting indeed. All right, well, shall we play a couple of adverts, Farrow? Let's play your Foundations of Entrepreneurship one.
Yeah.
I'll play Trivium as well, so encourage people to buy courses. And when we come back, we're going to start taking the questions. Oh, go on, Farrow, go on.
Yeah, I just want to quickly plug one other thing before the ads. I've also just launched a new screen print for this year. So if you go to my channel, and I've got a little video on it, take a look, and if you like it, drop me a note. But check out the ad for Foundations of Entrepreneurship now.
And just before we play the trivia, Mad, and get into the questions, if people remember last week, I couldn't figure out how to do the super thanks. I have now figured out how to do the super thanks. And there are super thanks going all the way back to the Evola video. But I will endeavor to do all of those before we get to the super chats, because there were super thanks. But basically it was just you have to filter them by super thanks, which is not as obvious as it seems. All right. Okay, buy Foundations of Entrepreneurship, get the Trivium, and when we come back, we're going to hit those questions. And like I said, you use it or lose it, so the stream will be as long as there are questions to cover.
Academic Agency.
All right. Okay, so if you're ready, Farrow, we can start with some super thanks, and then I'll do the super chats.
Sounds good.
First question comes from Tyler Santinelli, who says, what do you think of the subset of young Americans, that's another David Bowie era, by the way, the young American era, who read and think like Evola? So that is young Americans who read and think like Evola. Are we doomed to solipsistic navel gazing, or is there something in the spirit of this age we can make fire with? Thanks. Well, I mean, the first thing I'll say is that I would say in 2024, it almost doesn't matter if you're, for example, British or American or Italian or German, because in a sense, there was a famous headline once that said, we are all Americans now. In a sense, the poison that Evola was talking about has come to dominate all of those places. So if you're an American specifically, I wouldn't feel singled out by Evola, because he's basically talking about everybody at this point. And what he calls Americanism really is the reign of quantity that Guénon talks about, and a certain kind of a certain kind of anti-culture and anti-traditionalism, basically. So that's the first thing I'd say, is that everybody's in the same boat when it comes to that. The second part of it, are we just doomed to solipsistic navel gazing, or is there something that we can make fire with? Now, Pharaoh may have a slightly different answer to me on this, but my view is that we are children of the winter, and our special powers are in destruction and deconstruction, which is to say that we are particularly adept at tearing down the awful world that the people since 1945, including the boomers and everybody else, has built. We have unique talents at that. I am less convinced that we have talents to build the temple that comes afterwards, which is also a necessary part. That is my view. Other views are available. What do you think, Pharaoh, to that question?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. I think this point about understanding the time you're in, often on Twitter or whatever, when you've got profile picture and bio guys saying, Michelangelo did this by 29, kind of thing. I think you need to recognise that, we're in the time we're in, kind of thing. So you're never going to have that kind of moment. So I guess the question is, what can you do? I think you're right. This idea of deconstruction, or certainly kind of analysis of the past and of the present, is like a power. But also, I think it's an exciting time because we're at a position of almost kind of zero cultural production. So literally anything you do is better than what's being produced right now. That if you've seen the Turner Prize nominations, for example, where there's like a large car with a huge doily on the top was the winner, and it's kind of like, right, this is the current state of the arts, for example, right now. We're at an all-time low. So, if you were coming out and becoming a cultural producer 100 years ago, you'd have had so much competition. You'd have to be a real, top of your game. Well, I think what's interesting about now is we're just so in the gutter that even just doing something small can make a big difference. So that's what the way I think you've got to think of it, as like an exciting opportunity rather than to be sort of lost in nostalgia, I think, and to get overly sentimental for the past. We're in this moment where, like you said, the poison's already hit, the past has finished. What is now is the future,
Yes. I will just mention, because I'll probably forget if I don't mention it now. In the chat going past, somebody was asking me if I'm going to make a P. Diddy video. To my eternal shame, Pharaoh, in the late 90s, I was a Puff Daddy fan. I bought No Way Out by Puff Daddy and the Family and got into Notorious B.I.G. and various other things of that nature. And recently it's come out that, you know, P. Diddy is a bit of a diddler. Or what do you know? A guy who calls himself Puff Daddy turns out to be a puff. but so, yeah, next Wednesday, I'll make something on Puff Daddy, which will come out next Wednesday. See if any more details come out. But yeah, I'll address it then. All right. Next super thanks is NATO Tomato says, long live the EU USSR. So more of a comment than a question. A rat face has simply just given thanks. And our dictatorship says test slop. So some of these super things are not really questions, but I'll read them out anyway. Smith Dorian says, whilst I agree with your analysis, so this is on the Tony Blair post-liberal video, Pharaoh. I don't know if you had a chance to watch that one.
Yeah.
It says, whilst I agree with your analysis here, I still see Tony Blair as an NPC update to Harold Wilson, because he thinks that the problems of today can be overcome through automation and technology. Even though he steps over the slop, he will never be able to build moral unity between the elites and the people. He cannot correctly diagnose the problem, and his prescription is always perception management back to Fresh Prince. I mean, I'd largely agree with that analysis of Blair. Yes, I generally agree with that. I think if Blair was to hear that, though, he would be like, well, the thing is, through my powers of perception management, I can build something that closely resembles a moral unity, right? And it's interesting. In fact, it's interesting that Oasis made that comeback recently, because as I mentioned in that video I made on Oasis, at that, like, I don't think this actually happened, but it seems like if Keir Starmer had been less of an extremist and less of a kind of tyrant as he has been, he's been an awful person. It almost like it was set up for there to be this new moral unity between the people and the elites for New Labour 2.0, right? Literally back to Blair, back to the first time round for Oasis, okay? Obviously, that kind of went out the window the second Keir Starmer called everybody, well, did what he did, basically. But I think Blair would back himself to at least create the kind of facade or illusion of there being that moral unity. It's hard to explain how that was manufactured in the 90s, but it was. Think of a film like The Full Monty. I know that came out in the John Major era, but still, it was kind of, there was a bunch of films in the John Major years that were basically like paving the path towards Tone. And then when Tone came in, it was like, right, now all the stars are aligned. And it's like, you know, this is a prime minister who can go on Match of the Day and watches the same shows as you, and he can present Brit Awards to David Bowie and so on. And everybody's on the same page, right? So even though we know the consequences, there was more of a moral unity between the people and the elites in the late 90s than there is now. And I think he would say that he could manufacture that again. But what do you think, Pharaoh?
Yeah, well, one thing I would say is his focus on solutions as well, I thought was really interesting, where I think, yes, he wants to be a leader that has a vision which steps outside of mere popularism, but at the same time, I think he does recognize that there is a responsibility with that leadership, and he's kind of hitting some of those needs with those solutions. So, for example, I think it was at the Sky interview talking about the riots, for example, he was basically insinuating that they hadn't done enough to deal with the situation to prevent, to stop that moment from happening in the first place, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
So, like,
yeah,
I, I don't really see it quite like in the same way as sort of these traditional structures, basically. So,
I mean, one of the things that is interesting to me is how Blair was basically taking his cue from people who would be regarded as dictators, right? What does that really mean? Because as a dictator faces very similar incentives and constraints to the kings of old, right? Because if a dictator actually fails the people, it's all on him. And we all know what happens to dictators who, you know, the people turn on. You know, they can end up swinging from lampposts or deposed or invaded by America or whatever else. And so in a strange way, the dictator has to actually have that moral unity, that the high-low middle mechanism with the people versus some middle group that they attack, okay? This is the juvenile point. Now historically, populist dictators do that by appealing to the poor, the poor masses, against the moneyed middle classes, right? I feel that our elites have basically kind of broken that, because the poor masses they appeal to are essentially like third world foreigners at this point. And like, you know, the LGBT community and kind of, you know, people who are traditionally outcast. I mean, that is not the people. The people is the bulk of the people, the majority, right? They're trying to do it with all these ancillary client groups. Whereas, I mean, Donald Trump in America, who's a proper populist, is trying to form it. You know, he's almost doing it the traditional way. You know, the big strong man, the majority population, and who do you demonize? Well, all of those other groups in the middle. That's the proper way of doing the high low middle mechanism. But our elites do it in almost like an evil way. So,
well,
where the tone wouldn't go there, I don't think, because he is one of them. Ultimately, he created the systems. Yeah.
I mean, just a couple of things. Firstly, I would say that the Tories is like a high middle, really. If you think about your boomer or whatever, they would still be classed as, you know, relatively wealthy still. But going back to that point we talked about earlier, where, you know, I think historic class structures are breaking down in real time. And I think even idea, like, what makes someone middle class? Historically, it was money plus university plus culture. And basically, like I said, that it's being fragmented because the money has been lost from these traditional middle classes, but they still have like elements of the, I mean, even the culture's going, where like maybe, you know, think about if you go to an art gallery during the at any time, you'll see it's stuffed full of boomers, but not that many young people go in the same kind of way. And that is because there's just been a general decline in interest in culture. So what do you have really? You have, it's again, we're sort of entering this moment, you know, in the Goethe documentary, when they went from the ABC ones, etc., to more of this kind of audience style approach, where there's kind of clusters of people, the Mondeo man, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. That I feel is like what's happening in terms of these power blocks, where again, labor is working with, you know, whatever your immigrant family man or whatever, or the LGBTQ or whatever. So it's, I think it's a much more fractured system fundamentally, but I think the middle classes or the traditional middle class is going to take more of a kicking. And I think Keir has lined up a number of things. I think, you know, obviously the fuel allowance, the VAT thing against public schools, that's a classic attack on the middle. But then again, we talked about in the past about like Keir Starmer, who's he for? Like all he has really got is some of those kind of small groups. I don't think he has anything near like unity. The second thing I'm going to say, there was an amazing quote from that Tone interview where he said, where he was describing the two systems. Democracy is the power of the people. Dictatorship, whatever. And he sort of, kind of threw out It's like, I don't even care. It was such like a ballsy move, you know, whatever, really, you know. So I thought that was quite funny. But I had another quote from this as well, sorry, which was success or failure is down to leadership decision making and the quality of government. And I thought that was really interesting as well. Where again, and this sort of ties into his kind of solution thinking, isn't it, really, where not only do you kind of recognize that just like I imagine, just like incidents or whatever in Crusader Kings or whatever, you need to make the right decision at those kind of key points. You also need to field a government of quality. And again, I feel like not only has Keir shown his decision-making ability is very, very poor, but the quality of his government is really, really bad to such a degree that, you know, I saw Morgoth, Diana Abbott posting today or yesterday saying that, you know, she is the outstanding member of the party right now. And actually it's kind of like, oh, that's sort of true. And that's very depressing at the same time.
But Diane Abbott is now the adult in the room. I mean, they're awful. Rachel Reeves going through, looking at pictures of Disraeli and stuff and being like, I'm going to take all these down and replace them with pictures of crappy women, basically. I mean, it's just awful, this government.
Or even all the corruption stuff. It's kind of like, it's not the fact that the corruption happened, because I think most people had the inkling that, you know, behind the scenes handouts were happening, etc., for the Tories, obviously. But it was the just obviousness and then just not giving a crap about it. You know, they were just kind of flagrantly saying, like, yes, we're just sort of rubbing our kind of third world corruption in your face, basically. And I think that's just a sign of non-quality. My biggest concern is, like, Blair disappointingly backing Keir. And again, you made this point in the video where, he said that Keir made the right decisions for the riot. And it was just obvious at the time, and even, you know, retrospectively, that he made a series of very poor decisions, which led to an escalation of the issue. And I think even now, the issue has not been resolved. But what happens to Keir? Do you know what I'm saying? I don't think he's going to get stabbed in the back. Like the Tories stab their own in the back all the time. Labour do not. And the fact that Blair's sticking up for him, even despite the lowest opinion rating, what happens next? Is this four more years of nightmare?
I will say that Blair, though, smooth and Teflon snake that he is, has got many long-standing rules where he will not criticize anybody currently in politics. He even like David Cameron or even like Rishi Sunak or anybody, he has never criticized anybody in public. Same goes for American presidents as well.
And I think this is his fundamental weakness actually as a leader, because as a true Machiavellian, you know, no one is ultimately your friend. It's sort of you versus the world. But I feel like that Blair would never coup Keir. I don't think it would happen. I don't think he would have the balls to do it. And do you know what I'm saying? Weakness.
He is somebody in the Starmer government is briefing against Starmer and is leaking stories about Sue Gray in the press and, you know, this corruption scandal, the football tickets. And Blair is very much the sort of character who would smile in your face and knife you behind your back, or he'd say really nice things about you in public while also destroying you. I mean, he did it to he did it to a number of people in his actual cabinet, including Peter Mandelson, including Robin Cook, etc.
Yeah, but he got cooed by flipping Gordon Brown of all people, and I think you've got to remember it. This is the genuine weakness. I don't think, and again, there's a difference between briefing against someone and just, you know, put like whatever, whispering poison in people's ears behind their back, leaking stuff out. Anyone can do that. Would he get a group of MPs together, a form of an internal faction, and oust Keir? I don't think he has the ability to do that. And I think that this is one great weakness, is the inability to I know, like Purge kind of quasi friends, you know what I'm saying? I don't know.
His tendency is to try to work. His tendency is always to try to work with what is there.
Yeah, I think exactly. But But all of this briefing is to try and nudge Keir towards his centrist solution. But it hasn't worked though. All of these reports against him, all of the stuff, Keir's basically stood up and said, "I don't give a crap. I'm just carrying on my path of total destruction." You know, he's sort of he's off the rails, and like. This is what I'm saying, like short of him being removed by internal labor. Literally, did you see about the union conference that was happening recently, where they were literally trying to get a vote on about the winter fuel allowance? Like, whenever has the unions turned against the Labour Party in such a explicit way and so soon into like a Labour term? It's unprecedented, and he doesn't care, and he's not being nudged back. So what happens next? The only right thing to do would be for Tony to get a little posse of people together and get rid of him. But I just don't think he's going to do it.
The trouble that Tony has got is that his own faction is already kind of in power, like within the internal divisions of the Labour Party. The criticism's all coming from the left, right? It's coming from Diane Abbott or Bastani and Ash Sarkar, or it's coming from Starmer's left, right? Because that is where a lot of the membership still are, right? Despite his purges, it's still Labour at the end of the day, right? So a lot of the criticism is going to come from that side. So it's difficult for, because if Blair did a coup in Labour, it will be coming from the right, okay? But arguably within internal Labour politics, Starmer is already as right wing as it's possible to be for a Labour leader. If that makes any sense.
He needs to create a new, you mentioned your whatever socially conservative, economically liberal, politician. That's what you know in hyper normalization how Putin sort of fueled multiple groups or whatever. Blair should be working with Keir at the same time creating that kind of new faction, like you said, flanking from the right, trying to build up a voice around that, like basically trying to hit this the old 70s Labour voters, if that makes sense, who are like economically liberal but then socially conservative, and then coup with that group. That would be true Machiavellism. But like you said, this is what I'm saying. I think he's sort of stuck because his usual tactics of like nudging and briefing against just aren't working. Keir doesn't give a crap. I think let's just see if Gray steps down. I don't think she will do. I think they're all just brazen now. They don't care. They know they can get away with it. This is sort of like Keir is in some ways like Blair's Gollum to some degree. You know, he's a creation of.
Well, he's taken certain bits of advice, like ignore criticism and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
To heart, and he's taken like the top down bits of it without all of the finesse that makes it work for Blair. So in the end, you've just got this kind of crude authoritarianism. I will say though, you know, I had that video earlier on. Keir Starmer, landlord hater.
Yes,
and we were talking about the high-low middle mechanism. Interestingly, a lot of the comments on that video, when I say a lot, I would say maybe 5 to 1. I mean, you've got to expect most comments on an AA video are going to kind of be pro-me, right? But there was some pushback on that video of people being like, well, yeah, I hate landlords. I'm not going to shed any tears. And I was coming back on them and saying like, well, yeah, but you can either have like, you know, a normal landlord, or you can have BlackRock as the landlord. And some people have been like, yeah, I'll take BlackRock at this point. Fuck the boomers, basically. Or actually, my landlord isn't Mr. Smith, it's Mr. Patel or Mr. Khan or whatever. So, And apparently they have the Mr. Khans and the Mr. Patels have a reputation for not being like the best landlords. In fact, I think there was even a Labour MP who was caught up in a scandal recently, who was from that ethnic group, and he was like named and shamed for being a terrible landlord. Did you see that story?
Yes.
So that's even Keir Starmer that's a little bit of populism that he's engaged in. The attack on the landlords actually still works on some people who can't. I mean, Thomas Sowell called it thinking beyond stage one, right? My analysis was basically like, well, okay, but what happens next? Like, okay, and then what? That's the Thomas Sowell question. And then what? Well, the and then what is the landlords sell up and, you know, big multinationals or BlackRock types buy up, you know, buy up all the properties. But things are in such a state that people are saying, renters are saying, fuck it, I'll take BlackRock. So they've been like pounded into, if you're a renter in the current market, they you're almost kind of like, yeah, give me, I'll own nothing and be happy at this point. so that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Just on this idea of mega corporations owning, you know, huge assets in countries, I thought there was an interesting element to this as well, where, you know, how different countries' pension pots, you know, are also like one of those kind of big purchases, etc. And so I had this kind of dystopian vision of the UK moving to this kind of private, you know, the public-private partnerships, but where these national pension funds end up buying all the assets in a certain town. So imagine like Norway owning Swindon or something like that, you know, just like countries buying up an entire nation and all of the kind of an entire city and all of the assets within it. You know, no one actually British owning anything. It's all owned by foreign money. You know, this is sort of happening already with, you know, certain parts of London, like some of the nicer parts of London, with you know, Dubai Cash, for example, huge amounts of Chelsea, etc. But what if that was on a national scale? And again, just like a small, I like the idea of like Netherlands owning like a small town in England, and just like all of the parking receipts and everything goes back to the pension pot or something like that. Yeah,
just the mention of Bastani and Navarra Media set the chat off a little bit. I've noticed, Vero, that he started quietly liking my tweets. Nobody can see that on current Twitter, and he doesn't follow me, but he started liking my tweets, and not ones where I've mentioned him as well, and ones where I said pretty edgy things too. So that's interesting. Yeah. I'm wondering what arc Bastani's on. You know?
Yeah. Well, he's a dad, I think. I think that's probably like just all chemically changed him a little bit, but Bastani's okay. I think he's often got some pretty terrible takes, but I think he is a genuine soul, in the sense that I think a lot of leftists are just they will just NPC agree with whatever the leadership say about stuff, and I think he is more of a questioner about stuff. So, you know, what you really need to have is a good like fireside chat with him about a controversial topic to draw stuff out. So that's my, you know, gauntlet down. Bastani, if you're listening to this, you need to chat to AA and hash things out.
Rather than message him, I'm going to reach into the mystical fire and see if I can touch his Zoroastrian ancestry. See if I can just reach out through. Somebody told me Bastani is a Christian. I don't know if that's. I thought he was like a full-on Marxist, but anyway. I don't know. I mean, trying to judge by what he is liking, there's a streak of social conservatism in there, without doubt. He's not up for the Troon stuff, for example, as one example of one of the things I saw him like. You know, he may be up for traditional notions of traditional masculinity, gender roles, family unit. Unfortunately, he probably is a race communist, though. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. I almost see him like a William Morris-esque, like middle class Victorian socialist, basically, who are remarkably still socially conservative.
I also think that he doesn't like the idea of, you know, let's just say like English villages and things being turned into like miniature versions of Pakistan, right? But he hasn't reconciled that with his race communism, if that makes any sense. But he doesn't like the idea of it fundamentally. And from that, see, most politics comes from these disposition, these kind of gut feelings people have. And I can just tell his gut feelings are not always in a leftist direction. But he just doesn't, he has not been able to disaggregate, first of all, like the genuine right from the Tories, as one example. Or, you know, he cannot, it's kind of tricky coming from where he's coming from to divest yourselves of all of those kind of priors that you have. So he's kind of stuck in this weird thing where he's like a Marxist that doesn't like the way things are going, basically. And he's got a vague idea that the banks are behind everything, you know, that it's the international finance or whatever. And he doesn't like the forever wars, you know. So like, we're ticking things that we basically agree with here, but he's just not going to be able to go all the way because not unless we have a fireside chat anyway. All right, let's carry on. Next question comes from Thacker1290. This was on the Winston Churchill video. I don't know if you had a chance to watch that one, but
yes,
most of it wouldn't have been that new. Yeah, it wouldn't have been that new to you anyway. It's kind of like, you know, a bit of greatest hits in there. But this was ostensibly around Daryl Cooper and his interview with Tucker and a little excerpt from Boomer Truth Regime that I read. He says, is Churchill's resemblance to John Bull significant to his symbolic power? John Bull has faded over time. Churchill has supplanted him as the archetypical Anglo. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think that Churchill as the bulldog is part of his appeal or part of his meme ability. For people who aren't familiar, I'll just get up a picture of John Bull because you can see what we'll be talking about here.
He's like a personification, of what it is to be British, isn't it? So, or English, I should say.
Yeah, that kind of like never say die attitude, a kind of grit and determination. What else like really typically kind of
kind very, very, of very, very well fed on delicious beef is again a genuine jungle meme basically, but it's, you've got to see it as counterpoise to the French, the starving French post-Napoleonic or whatever, you know, the price of revolution.
There he is, look, there's John Bull. But there is a kind of there's a never say die attitude, isn't there, that comes along with this John Bull character, you know, this idea that even if you're outnumbered, you wouldn't give up type thing, you know, that you do your duty to God and country.
Mm.
Does this not go along with it?
I think you're right. And I think to the super chat's point, I think there is some kind of symbolic, deeper memory that's being tapped into with that. I mean, it's interesting. So again, this is a poster from World War One, still referencing John Bull, but notice how he's been totally sort of written out of the kind of even vernacular culture again. You know, if you were to ask a guy off the street who John Bull is, unless they happen to like read old Punch magazines or, you know, that kind of stuff, they wouldn't know. So it's kind of interesting post First World War as an iconic figure. He's sort of been removed, but I wonder if it's like John Bull doesn't make sense in the vision for a multicultural England. You know, to have a personification of a country is to say what it is on average in some ways, isn't it? So I don't think that John Bull fits even with like the 1950s Commonwealth Britain, for example. So while, you know, Churchill has that kind of global appeal. He has some of those kind of elements of, you know, quote unquote bravery, etc. So maybe he is the kind of stand-in figure. Certainly, in terms of like, has there been a figure as memorialized and iconicized as Churchill? I would say only like Lenin, Marx and Stalin. You know, you see little kind of busts and heads of them in every communist household for years after. It's the same with Churchill. It's literally he's everywhere. He's on, you know, he's on pictures, on, you know, he is almost like a Warholian Warholian, pop art figure.
The one area where I wonder if John Ball persisted a bit longer was in the Toby jug. I feel like most, or once upon a time, most pubs would have at least had a nod to this kind of thing that you'd see, you know, could be on the mantelpiece or, you know, you know the sort of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, definitely.
See on the screen. So I think that may have persisted kind of in the undercurrent, but it certainly wasn't pushed in the mainstream culture in any real way. Obviously, I grew up in Wales, where that sort of thing is less pushed because it's all Welsh stuff. It's all like the Welsh flag, Welsh identity, etc. The composite British identity is less popular, I guess, in Wales, for obvious reasons. Bill Wilson says, I'm trying to think of other people honestly, I think it's like after a certain point, it's like figures like James Bond or Doctor Who, or, you know, it's like popular or Harry Potter, even to some extent, is a British character, right? It becomes like pop culture, superheroes and shit like that. But that's kind of what's taking the place of those sorts of icons. And Churchill is the closest thing to a real person who is made like that. There was a cult of Thatcher in some places, but obviously she was a polarizing figure. Speaking of Wales, I remember.
I was going to say, I thought that cult was for conservative transgender.
Well, I was saying I had a I knew someone once who was lived like in the heart of Wales, right? Proper old-fashioned Labour town, right? But her dad fucking loved Thatcher, and when you went in, they had one of those old dressers, right, with Thatcher plates, Thatcher memorabilia, everything, right? His whole family voted Labour. The whole street voted Labour. His thing was that he was a massive Thatcher fanboy. And he kind of did it defiantly and belligerently. I kind of respected that in a way because, but it was also like kind of, you know, yeah, here's a nice Thatcher plate. You know what I mean? I'm pretty sure he had I think he had one Thatcher one. And you know, those kind of Princess Diana, like royal family memorabilia stuff. I think he had like a nether wall, which was royal family stuff as well. So he was kind of like, you know, the only Tory boy in the village, if that makes any sense. So, yeah. Anyway, next super chat is, or next question is Bill Wilson, who on last week's Office Hours said, I see why you hate his World of the Worlds. But what could you possibly have against Jurassic Park? This is my tirade against Steven Spielberg last week. I'd have to watch Jurassic Park again to answer that question. Did Spielberg do Jurassic Park? He did he?
Yeah, he did.
I always forget that's part of his oeuvre. Maybe, I mean, I might give him Jurassic Park because I remember it being quite an effective film in the cinema. I'd have to rewatch it though. I bet you there's a hidden slab of horrible propaganda in there, which you wouldn't. We'll take my EDI to ferret it out, but we'll see. Ralph Gilson Baker says, and this again is on the Blair Post Liberal video. I still believe that the Network of Tens concept is the best reaction which has been offered at all. Do you think that this idea is still worth pursuing? This video is a 10 production, by the way. Oh, well, thank you very much for that, Ralph. Yeah, I mean, I still think the Network of Tens concept is a goer. And I also think that it's in motion. It's happening. It has been happening since I said it, really. And it continues to happen. So I'm kind of pleased about that. Do you agree with that, Farrah? Kind of.
Yeah, definitely. I think it goes back to points and discussions about quality that we heard, and again the kind of the need for it, the importance, the value that it has with decision making as well. And again, I think decision making is again a really interesting qualifier for a 10, where it's kind of like you need to know when to say the right things or how to act in a certain way. And I think there is a sort of whittling process happening through time naturally that's going on. But also I wonder whether some of the latest attacks on the middle, for example, are going to generate more people and high quality, which is going to be a danger. So for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I generally agree with that. Although I have an aversion to, I've always got an eye on containment, as you know, Pharaoh. And I still think a lot of people they don't have a good feel for who is and is not containment. And there's still too much of a willingness to believe that certain ends can be achieved with certain figures. Like, I'm just trying to give an example off the top of my head. Matt Goodwin, say. I mean, I just have no interest in working with him whatsoever. Mm. And yet there are people in our spheres who just can't wait, they just can't wait to, they think it's brilliant, they just can't wait to talk to him. Matt Goodwin, as an example.
Oh, okay.
Right. I mean, to me, this is like, well, come on. It's just obvious. I don't even need to explain why. But obviously, that's not enough for some people. And I think there's a problem where when something gets to a certain size, and they talk about this in the Elite Theory stuff, Robert Michels in particular, the Iron Law of Oligarchy, right? Once you reach a certain size, once it reaches a certain threshold, you get a different type of character entering the scene. Someone who's kind of a social climber, for example, or ambitious, or someone who's there to network or whatever. And once you get those sorts of characters in, then the types of people who are attracted change as well. And they become people who are actually just in it for the power part, right? Mm. They're in it to be part of the machine. And this is how the Iron Law of Oligarchy is able to win again and again and again, right? Because you end up becoming part of the system. And I don't know what to do about that, because it's kind of, I mean, I've just seen enough cycles come and go where it's like, well, there's basically no, like, when somebody's of that bent or somebody's of that sort of character, there's no telling them, basically. There's no reasoning with them. They're going to do it anyway, right? So it's like, well, okay, fair enough, but now now you're part of Matt Goodwin's thing, which is not really where any of us wanted to go, if that makes any sense, right?
Yeah. I think there's two things here. Like, I think, like you said, it's sort of an inevitability over size, and it's kind of like, how do you deal with it? I think some people's response is to kind of like, try and sort of quarterize or cut those people out entirely. Like, I think that there is some strength in that, but like, I think you need to have strength in your own view and your own ends. Do you know what I'm saying? You can sort of cut someone off, or you can have strength in yourself, strength in those ideals, and that defeats him. I mean, Goodwin's interesting in my opinion, because I think he, I think he's, like you said, genuine containment in the sense that he sort of wants to come back to, like, if you can actually read through the lines and some of the stuff he's saying, he does want to return to this kind of Fresh Prince style ultimately, and the form of like quasi multicultural Britain essentially. But I think, to his credit, I think he has kind of recognized that all attempts at trying to return his version of Return. You know, we've got our version of Return. There's the Fresh Prince Return have failed and are on the pathway to failure. I think he recognizes where the regime is going wrong. I think he's sort of like a lone voice in the wilderness saying, look, we need to do something about this, otherwise it's going to snowball. I think
you may be a bit more connected than that.
Yeah, well, no, but you maybe you're right in terms of connections. I don't know, but I think, but his in terms of his profile and his strength to turn people to his side, he just doesn't have. He's not getting the interest. I don't think he's like. I don't know whether the whole sort of the market has already gotten past his point. But I don't see him having like a Farage-esque moment. He seems to be, in terms of kind of his profile, he's stuck on Unheard Who Is It For style platforms forever. He's always going to be a B-lister. He's never going to be an A-lister in terms of like star power. So like, even though I think he's the most dangerous person in terms of containment. I think he's got the strongest form of containment that's out there, because you know what he says is very strong, and it's well argued and well reasoned, but it's essentially, like I said, if you see what he actually wants, it is that kind of Fresh Prince-esque return. But then I think the market's gone beyond him. I think the people have gone beyond him now.
Let me tell you what I mean though, right?
Yeah, go on.
And this is going to sound like a personal attack on this guy, but frankly, I don't care. Somebody sent me a video of him walking through the street smoking a cigar at one point. And I couldn't help but think, if it was anyone else, I'd be like, oh, yeah, okay, cool, fair enough. But I couldn't help but think he's just gone down there. He doesn't smoke cigars. He's doing this to adopt a style, to try to get over with a certain audience in a straightforwardly Machiavellian way. Because he has some notion that this crowd likes cigars, okay? Whether he knows why or not or whatever, it struck me as inauthentic, okay? Because there's the element of the manufactured think tankery about him, okay? And I cannot, like, for me, that's just a kind of gut instinct. Yeah, there's something off about this guy, right? I can tell he's faking. I can tell he's not. He's doing that to adopt a style, not because he's into Cuban cigars. Okay. I could even tell he's just gone into a shop there and they've passed him a Monte Cristo, basically, as what has happened. But he felt the need to film himself walking down the street smoking a cigar, as an example. And one of the things I always liked about our thing, if that makes any sense, is that everybody was basically authentically themselves and not trying to adopt some sort of stance to get in with certain people. Does that make any sense? So there's just that element of fakery about it all that I don't like. And I've got my it gets my spidey senses up. I'll just put it that way. I mean, he's not the only one. He's just one I'm picking up today.
Like the thing is, I think a lot of people who do that, you know, obviously like Lawrence Fox and that kind of ilk, it's a similar kind of deal. But then I think that someone like Lawrence is just, again, doesn't have the kind of intellectual capability to kind of argue in those spaces. Well, Goodwin's yeah. But my question is, again, just like Unheard, who is Matt for though? Is he really trying to come in as this kind of like sort of de-radicalizing figure for the right? I thing is, I see him as more kind of like containment for the like boomer normies, if that makes sense. Like I think, like I said, he's trying to diffuse the increasing situation by offering a different pathway. It's kind of like I almost see like if Tony Blair was actually in government as opposed to dictator Keir, I feel like he would be doing some of the kind of stuff that Godwin is
suggesting.
Yeah, exactly. So that's so I don't think he's actually for us, really. I think he is actually more to kind of diffuse the bigger situation, which is the out of control lows who have basically given up on the system entirely.
My sense is that, and again, Scrump and Evelyn have talked about this ad nauseum as well, there's a crowding out that occurs, though, where they think, well, this is a space, something is happening here. Now, even if we can't get to their event or we can't, like, those guys are too switched on to let us in, we can take their pie. We can take their, whatever's happening over there, we can, just by saying similar sounding stuff, we can get some portion of people back on the reservation, because I'm talking about immigration too or something, right? But maybe I'm too, I mean, frankly, it doesn't matter what I say, because it's going to happen anyway. This is just, you know, things as they are. I'm just saying that that's one problem with the network of tens thing that I haven't worked out the solution to yet. Mm-hmm. And it's built in. It's literally the iron law of oligarchy, that part beyond a certain size, beyond a certain kind of modicum of organization and success, you then face this problem of the iron law of oligarchy, where a character, I mean, if it's not that guy, it'll be this guy, and this guy. It's just that sort of person who's got a nose for, you know, plugging into a network, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's carry on. Next question comes from Red Plastic Plane. This was from the Keir Starmer landlord hater video. He says, do you have any info thoughts on if they'll come after stocks and shares, ISAs, and how they might control crypto? If you're fighting the regime when it comes to property, is there a way to invest in the same game the elites play? For example, owning shares in the megacorps, TAR. I don't think they will come after the stocks and shares, ISAs, because they are literally managed by BlackRock themselves. I mean, I've got a couple of those, and they're managed by BlackRock. I was informed afterwards, because I thought it was some other dude, and then I got the little thing through, and there's this little tag, and it just says managed by BlackRock. I was like, oh, thanks for telling me. So one way or the other, it ends up being managed by one of the big players anyway. So I don't think they're not going to go over those. And I mean, I think there are people who basically just track the market. You know, I'm not a finance guy, but my understanding is you can actually set up a thing to just track whatever investments, say, BlackRock make, and you just do the same ones. So you just follow the market, because, you know, those big players basically do dictate the market at this point. And can you own shares in megacorps? I mean, you can, but the thing is with trying to do it yourself, i.e., you know, oh, I'm going to buy 1,000 Coca-Cola stock or whatever, is that they can, like, you can lose a lot of money doing that, or you can gain a lot of money. I mean, it's just like gambling, right? So the whole idea of giving it to one of those ISAs is that they can manage the risk on your behalf, and you don't have to think about it. They know what they're doing, basically. So,
correct answer for this was, you need to be investing in yourself by going to the foundation's website and purchasing a mega bundle.
Yeah, that's
forget
true,
investing in ethereal stocks and shares. That's not real money. Or knowledge is the real money. Anyways, right, I'll stop the plug.
What you could do if you did foundations of writing and then wrote a grant proposal, or I don't know, wrote that pivotal pitch that you need to give, right? The Trivium could help you do that. It could help you nail that pitch or the grant proposal or whatever it is that you have to write, because the principles of clear communication are applicable to every walk of life. The email you send your boss, you know, all these different areas, foundations of writing will help you in. So
I've got one entrepreneurial idea. You know, maybe with the government attacking second homes for rent, attacking ISAs, attacking crypto, we need to return to coins in jars. You know, you see like archaeologists have dug up Roman coins in jars. I'm going to be selling jars that you can fill with loads of coins that you have to bury and the government can't get to it. You know, you see like those kind of gold adverts at the beginning of the Judge Knapp videos. Mm-hmm. Pharaoh's coins and jars. You can invest now and get a jar to put all of your money in.
I know, you'd see a bigger return of those. Do you remember those penny slot machines? You'd stick the 2p in and it falls down it pushes the 2p's and then they... in fact, I think they're still big in some places, those 2p slot things. they may be a big return of them, though. Anyway, let's carry on. O.T. Tom says, we are going to win. It's just a matter of when. Joseph Steedin says, for Zoomers, Winston Churchill was an amateur astronomer who went on to play the Games Master in the 1990s Channel 4 game show of the same name. He is, of course, talking about Patrick Moore. And I loved Games Master when I was a kid.
That's great. Was it Dominic Diamond?
Dominic Diamond, yeah.
Brilliant. It was really good. It was so crap, but also so good as well. So,
Daniel Sweet says, what is your favorite biscuit? Ooh, I'd have to think about that. In terms of just a biscuit that you'd go and buy a packet of biscuits, I like a shortbread. I like you can buy a tin of Scottish shortbread.
I was going to say, do you get the little Scottish Highlands themed or just a classic?
I like them in a tin. The other ones I really like are the blue Danish ones. I think I can't remember what that's called. Danish shortbread, I think it's called, but it comes in a blue circular tin. And there's one which is a swirl and there's one which has got like sugar on it. You can get them in like posher village stores and things like that. I don't know if you can get them in the supermarket, but I like those, the Danish, the blue tin. Those would be my favorite picks. Anybody who knows my cigar tastes, I like the H-Up one, that's shortbread kind of flavor cigar, basically. So, yeah, I veer towards shortbread. I will admit, though, I do love an American-style white chocolate and macadamia nut cookie as well. In the American soft cookie, you can get it from a cafe or something. I love those,
yeah,
too. But, yeah.
Firstly, just custard cream, like a well-made custard cream is the best. Just on cookies, there's been some serious shrinkflation where, I haven't bought, you know, you could buy those kind of like nice American-style cookies fresh from a supermarket. I did that the other day, and then they're about half the sizes of what I remember them. It was terrible. Everything's just getting smaller.
A lot of people are mentioning Rich Tea biscuits in the chat. I tell you who has become a big fan of Rich Tea biscuits, and that is AAA. I've got a pack of Rich Tea biscuits, just it's like on the counter or whatever. And she keeps on going and finding it and eating it. And I said, "Oh, you like those Rich Tea biscuits?" And she said, "Oh, they don't taste like biscuits. They're not normal biscuits." And yeah, she's really into those. So yes, at least one person is a Rich Tea fan. Okay, what else have we got? Reinholder says, slips note under door. Professor, it seems your door is locked. I'd like to hand in my essay titled The Emerging American Blair. Now, who would that be? I mean, if there was an American Blair, the closest thing would probably be Obama, if I had to guess. Yep. I mean, who would you say, Pharaoh?
Yeah, no, for sure.
It's Obama, isn't it? It's,
he literally visited Kiev the other day, didn't he? So
I feel like Obama has been less successful at locking down American politics than Blair has. Although, to be fair, a lot of similar things did happen after Blair's time here. For example, the loss of the Labour Party to the lunatic left did actually happen, as did the loss of the Democrats to the lunatic left happen in America. The polarization has been less marked, though, because what Blair did that Obama was unable to do was basically transform the conservatives into being Blairites. The Americans, the GOP, You can say what you want about the GOP. They never became like Obama light. There was never like a Republican Obama. Even in Mitt Romney, John McCain form, they still weren't Obama, were they? They were very much still Republican. So,
yeah,
I would say that the Obama failed in that respect. And you could say the biggest failure of Obama was creating Trump, whereas the biggest success of Blair was the fact that our version of Trump, which was Boris Johnson, was basically a Blairite. You know, but Ben Cook says, are you familiar with social credit? Wrong on econ, but seems solidly right wing, even on edgy topics. To me, seems very pro Kulak and very anti Nordonic and Mushnik. Now, I'm assuming that social credit is a person, not the concept of social credit. If so, I have not come across this person. Have you heard of social credit as a, I'm guessing, a content creator of some sort, Pharaoh?
No, but I would say that I feel like there's been a huge number of new figures coming out of nowhere with huge, huge viewships. And I don't know whether it's just like new people doing well with the algorithm or just genuinely being boosted from somewhere else. But like channels coming out of nowhere, getting tens of hundreds of thousands of views and stuff, it fascinates me because they're obviously doing like something, or they have some kind of connection, meaning they're not kind of being withheld in the algorithm, basically. So maybe that's part of this kind of new tranche of people. But I essentially just don't trust anyone that has come from nowhere.
Yeah, it's funny, Farrell. A lot of us old heads now, whenever anyone's like, who's this guy? And somebody in the chat is just like, yeah, no way that's real. No way that's organic type thing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember that guy who is well liked by Kurt Doolittle. Everybody thought, well, is this John? Remember there was that guy, John Mark, with the helmet, who was like, oh, there's going to be a civil war. How are the two sides going to do? And he got hundreds of thousands of views. And then there was that big meeting where Kurt Doolittle pissed himself. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And John, after that, John Mark deleted his channel and was never seen again. Everyone was like, was that guy a Fed or what? Well, anyway, there's this new guy now, I forget his name, who, very similar to John Mark, came out of nowhere and right off the gate is getting like 200,000 views and things like that, which made people think, well, is this just John Mark again? So, yeah, that is a bit odd. That is a bit strange. Then again, as I've been learning, Pharaoh, I mean, I have been basically a stream, like in terms of my YouTube presence, I've been more or less a streamer for the past 4 years, right? I've been out of the video making game, as it were. But like an old cowboy riding back to town, I've had to learn how the meta has changed in the video making world, right? And, you know, the thumbnails, the logo, all this fucking bullshit. You know, the length, what time you do it at, you know, keyword searches. I mean, you know, the meta changes. Like what worked back when I was doing Jeremy Clarkson was right about Sadiq Khan, you know, what works kind of changes over time a little bit. And I've had to be like learning that as I'm making more videos now. But in the process, I've learned of a number of channels that, you know, seem to be doing quite well. There's a guy called Richard the Fourth, right? I was like, well, he seems to be like, he's a brand new up on the British politics scene, you know, somehow has escaped our notice, or he's not plugged into any of us and our friends. But to be fair, he makes decent videos. He's got good thumbnail game, and he gets good numbers. And much like, me, Pharaoh, I have a competition in me. I hate most people. I need to have someone in my sights, right? And this chap, Richard the Fourth, is the guy I've got. Oh, hold on. Pharaoh has dropped out here. Where's he gone? Pharaoh. It says you will need to connect your mic or cam. Pharaoh, I think your microphone has come out. Uh-oh. Well, anyway, yeah, Richard the Fourth is the person, much like Daniel Plainview in There Will Be Blood, that I got in my sights, and I'm gonna drink his milkshake. I don't really mean it, but I'm benchmarking the performance of my videos against his to see if my new thumbnail game and way of making videos is at least being competitive on the level of Richard the Fourth.
Drainage.
Yes, Pharaoh's still making up his, he's still doing his mic, so I will let him in when he's able to. But no, I'm not familiar with social credit. Blue Wizrope says, we all know Churchill was bad, but what do you think was the worst thing he did? In terms of, like, in my view, the worst thing Churchill did was his belligerence over World War II, getting us into a conflict which could have been avoided, and a conflict, more importantly, that we could not win on our own. He went into that war with a game plan of drawing the Americans in. And frankly, in my view, that is evil. What Churchill did in terms of engineering, essentially what was World War II, I think that was evil, personally. Which is not to say that, I love the mid-century Germans, or I think that they are beyond criticism and all of that sort of stuff. I don't think that at all. They did plenty of bad things too. I'm just saying that from any classic point of view of British self-interest and the self-interest of the British Empire, he basically squandered the lot to take us into a war that we couldn't win in order to deliver the world basically into, you know, one half being ruled by Stalin and the other half being poisoned slowly by the Americans, which is basically the world that we live in today. So I really do hold him responsible. And next Monday, I have a video coming out, a long one. It's like 50 minutes long, plus the Monday book video by Major General Richard Hilton. It's called One World Government, A Warning. And it was written in 1958, and it's him talking about the fallout of World War II and basically the world situation as it existed in 1958 and how buggered the world was and Britain specifically was as a result of Churchill's actions. He could have chosen differently, basically. There is all sorts of different things he could have done. So for me, the ultimate bad for Churchill was starting the Second World War. And I do think that he is responsible for starting it. Otherwise, why did he turn down 20 peace offers from the Germans? I mean, he reminds me very much of the British government now, which is basically hell-bent on getting us involved more with a war on Russia. The Americans don't want it. The Europeans don't want it. The Russians don't want it. The Ukrainians want it, right? But I mean, in exactly the same way as our government is carrying on now, they've learned that from Churchill. That is the belligerence and the fucking stupidity of Churchill for me. Many people find that admirable. I just think it's stupid, especially when he said in the 1940 or 1941, I did not become the prime minister to give away the empire, or words to that effect. And that is exactly what he did. He still, the country is still not recovered from the crippling situation that he left it in. So for me, the worst leader of all time for Britain. There are many other bad things he did, right? I mean, I haven't even talked about the First World War or, you know, famines halfway around the world. But frankly, I don't care about those. I care about the main bad thing he did, which was World War II. Reacted Brainwave says...
Sorry.
You're back, Farrow. You're back.
Yeah. Sorry. I just wanted to kind of chip in as well. Just a couple of things. Firstly, I just find people have just no imagination where they think it's either kind of like Britain had to ally with, you know, one, like America and especially FDR had multiple times said they wanted to dismantle empire. Like, so it was like you were literally allying with someone that wanted to ultimately destroy you. And but I see it as like a total failure of imagination that you can't think of any other way to resolve the situation rather than, you know, being with the either with the Nazis or against them. You know, there's a thousand things I could have thought of. You know, you could, you know, stay neutral, you could try and form different alliances. But I think there's something fundamentally like warlike to Churchill's personality. I almost see him as some kind of like god of war made manifest, where he just had a great desire throughout his life. I mean, someone was pointing out how brave he was and all of the engagements he's in, but and I think there's a truth to that in the fact that he was certainly not afraid of death. And but where when do you move from bravery to just a love of war itself and war above everything else? And I think that's for me, I think one of his great faults is that he desired war above the health and happiness of the British people. And just on your point about the peace offers stuff, I think the idea of unconditional surrender to be an exceptionally evil one, and weirdly unprecedented. Like, why was it specifically used in this circumstance? Like, no other time in history have we had such like brutal desire to totally crush our enemies. You know, even like the First World War didn't have those kind of terms of engagement. And I think something like unconditional surrender sounds great until it happens to you. And I do wonder whether one day, because I do feel like the West has a very similar Churchillian attitude. They're going to be on the receiving end of some of that unconditional surrender one day.
Yeah, I absolutely. To me, this is the problem, is that even if you say, well, okay, even if you try to give like a positive appraisal to Churchill, the fact that all our leaders then continue in this Churchillian mode, it's mental. We can't live in a world like this, and yet we do. We continually do, and it's, you know, it could end up getting us all killed one day, or could end up being the same attitude that starts World War III. Because
even Lamy today, again, it's sort of like being, like I said, it's being possessed by the god of war. That literally, it's a form of possession. Why is Lamy advocating for this? Like, what skin do we have in this game? Like, at least with Biden or whatever, you could recognize the fact he's got those, or supposedly had the family connections to deals and stuff. But like, genuinely, like, what skin do we have in Ukraine? What does David Lammy have? Like, surely he can't be bought into some kind of dark or current scheme. And I think the only thing I can see, like you said, it's just people trying to live out, you know, being Churchill still. And I think that works well while you're winning, but as soon as you're losing, severe consequences.
And so. I would like to point out that the true legacy of Churchill is the fact that a man like David Lammy, with all that entails, is the foreign secretary of this country now.
Literally, right. Literally wears trainers to diplomatic events.
David Lammy is our foreign secretary. I mean, there were several times reading that Richard Hilton book, which you'll see that video on Monday, where I just thought, imagine a man like Major General Richard Hilton seeing London today, or seeing like what had become of Britain. And the funny thing is that I believe that the men of that stripe, the men who actually fought in World War II, like him and various other writers, knew that that was coming. You can tell from what they were writing and what they were saying. In fact, there are times where the British guys sound oddly like Julius Evola, right? Even though they're coming from a different place, they knew the risk with the getting into bed as much as we did with the Americans, and actually, you know, the extent to which America was a fundamentally anti-empire, anti-European, and anti-traditional power, that would, you know, literally end up with a place like David Lammy, you know, as prime minister. I mean, there's a moment in the Richard Hilton where he says something like, and just imagine African savages having the same vote as you or I. This was only 1958 now. I'm thinking, my God, you only had to go forward like 20 years or something for that to be happening. So anyway, go on, Farrah.
I just a note, because I feel like there's been quite a few of these kind of revisionist history books done by British guys, but they were all seem to be ex-military. And I thought that was I wonder whether there, again, it's that there's some kind of, there's something there where, you know, that either the lived experience or, again, personality type versus kind of managerialism, you know, fighting against it.
I mean, I think the important thing to remember about those books is that they were not written as revisionist history. They were not, like, when they were writing them, they just thought that they were giving an account of what happened, or they were just talking about facts on the ground type thing. They have, because a lot of these books were written in the 40s, 50s, 60s, before Boomer Truth had cemented. It is only in hindsight that they look revisionist, because, in the case of Major General Richard Hilton, it's basically impossible to get hold of those books. You know, they've never been reprinted. They're not converted into PDFs. They're not easily available. My version is literally a copy that was removed from the National Library of New Zealand. The equivalent of the British Library. So yeah, I have got the New Zealand copy of that book from their National Library, but that also means that the National Library of New Zealand no longer has that book. Anyway, we'll continue. Redacted Brainwave says, it seems to me that techno-globalists believe in management through distributed systems. Are they proving this management style possible, or the opposite? Well, obviously some part of it works, because the world does tick on and you do get your, you know, I can ring up the delivery driver to bring me some slop right now if I wanted to. So those parts of it work for the time being. But I don't know. I feel like it has a fragility that is not always acknowledged. This was something that Nicholas Nazim Taleb talked about in his various books on anti-fragility and Black Swan and all that. I feel like when things start to go wrong, it will be really obvious when they go wrong. But they haven't quite started to go wrong on a scale where it's noticeable in day-to-day life yet, although we're getting there. Any thoughts to that, Farrah, or should we move on?
No, just carry on.
Wildcard said, I'm trying to market the current economic crisis as the Great Western Recession, since it aligns blame better than the Silent Depression. Any thoughts or better titles for it? The current economic crisis, the Great Western Recession. I would like to allocate blame squarely on the current ruling elites, if possible. You know, Great Western seems to socialize the blame to me. I would like to localize the evil more. Call it like, I don't know. I haven't got any ideas of how to do it right off the top of my head, though.
Also, I would say that it's not a recession in the traditional sense, either, like a Black Monday style moment of, you know, plunging profits and market crash. And it's not even a slow decline. It's if you see it, what it is the GDP per capita line is flat, but then you've layered on severe inflation over that, like since 2008. So again, I mean, the economist bros know more than me about this, but it seems to me more like the Japanese style, shrinkflation style economy, where And also there's a like there's a productivity angle there as well, something that Maven often points out, where you know, we import people thinking they're going to work as hard as or generate as much cash as the existing population are, and they never seem to. So like I don't think you're going to get a pithy one line name for what's going on, but it's certainly not a traditional recession, I would say. It's this kind of like slow malaise, this kind of we're slowly drowning in quicksand or the swamp, you know. That's what it feels like.
Rob Earl, 1983, said, I am enjoying your podcast while working here at the Windsor Assembly Plant in Canada. Well, hello, Rob, in Canada. What are you making in the Windsor Assembly Plant then? I'm glad that Canada still has a manufacturing, to be honest. I wonder what they make. Is that airplanes? If I had to guess. What are they making at the Windsor Assembly Plant? I'm going to look it up. I like people doing, like, you know, they make cars in the Windsor Assembly Plant. Cars. Chryslers. Chrysler minivans. Apparently. Well, that's good that Justin Trudeau hasn't shut that down. Yeah, they make Chryslers there. And Dodge Chargers as well. Excellent. Excellent. And speaking of Canada and Justin Trudeau, next Thursday I have a video on Justin Trudeau and Keir Starmer compared side by side that has been guest penned and narrated by the Black Horse, who is a Canadian finance bro, who very kindly offered that up. I have been very interested in the extent to which Keir Starmer is basically using the Justin Trudeau WEF playbook. It's become less trendy to talk about WEF and things like that now, but I reckon this new Labour government, this Starmer government, is basically just through and through WEF, Pharaoh. I know it's not very original, but it just seems like all the things he's doing are pretty much back on that kind of Agenda 2030 stuff.
Well, I'm sort of fascinated with WEF as like a mimetic concept, because again, people came to it first from, you know, some of their videos and some of the stuff they were saying. Then, like, I think there was a huge fixation on Schwab as a character and as a person, and then I think it took this kind of conspiracy turn to it. Again, I'm not against the idea of conspiracies, but conspiracy-brained people were quite into it, you know, kind of like Schwab doing secret cult rituals, sacrificing poodles to the WEF god or something like that. And then, so I think people lost their minds, especially when it hit the kind of boomosphere.
Yeah, during COVID as well.
Yeah, and COVID as well, again. But, it hasn't sort of changed, and I think the kind of ideas behind it are still true. And I think WEF as a topic needs to be re-engaged with some of that kind of boomer conspiracy removed a little bit, like less kind of like look at Klaus Schwab, he's a scary guy in a weird suit, and more kind of like, well, what have the people there actually been saying? What have they been advocating for? And like you said, I imagine it's stuff like you say about, you know, wouldn't it be better if corporations own all of the properties to rent out to people? Wouldn't it be better if we have an international digital ID card for everyone? You know, and I imagine that, like, Keir is interesting because he isn't really trying to placate any of his patron class. And also, I think he's trying to tackle the economic crisis in a very weird way. So, you know, he's trying to cut, he's doing the austerity play, you know, cutting back on winter fuel allowance, but then he's not cutting back on things like, you know, international aid, you know, just basic stuff that you would cut back on if you were really trying to save cash. So it's kind of like, imagine if the WEF did a did an austerity budget, basically. They're like, oh, yeah, well, we can't cut back on international aid because that's fundamental. It's a fundamental part of our global vision, you know. Or, you know, he's getting the you know, getting advice from WEFI type people to not do that. But it, I mean, I think it looks bad. And I think, I wonder what they've been saying basically the last year. So
I've got images of Tone being in the room where they're discussing, and they, you know, somebody suggests we could cut the foreign aid budget, and him just going, no, that's mine. You don't, you know, because that's basically all that money goes to him and his friend. That's the NGO network grift, basically, is the foreign aid budget goes to all of that. So anyway, so I couldn't resist, though, for that one on One World Government next week, slipping Schwab into the thumbnail. It's so hard to resist, but it's basically boomer bait to hit them with.
It is.
Richard Hilton. Like they're going to click on it, expecting a Steve Turley video, and it's me going to be reading Major General Richard Hilton for 50 minutes. It's going to be amazing.
Brilliant. I think just one thing on the Schwab thing again. It's kind of like, I think that the interest and the power is not in what Schwab has to say, if I'm honest with you. You know, he's obviously the figurehead. But if you've ever been to like a business corporate meet or corporate conference beforehand, you know that they'll have various tracks on a couple of different days talking about different subjects, and the interesting stuff comes from things like the round tables, where you've got four or five people in a specific area. Maybe they'll get like a couple of civil servants, maybe they'll get an NGO, maybe they'll get a couple of politicians to talk about a specific area, because that gives you insight into how they're thinking and what their vision is for the future, or for specific subject matter experts. So you'll always have one or two stars, but it's really not about Schwab, in my opinion. And that's like the danger is not about Schwab. It's about creating this global alignment of a vision that goes beyond the nation's population. So again, like Keir's made it clear that he doesn't care about old people, or he cares about you know, maintaining the foreign aid budget, and so over old people. In my opinion, that's putting the lives of foreigners over the lives of your own population, and that's the big concern for me for some of the kind of WEF ideology.
I should mentioned, by the way, that as the show has been going, people have been sending me images of BlackRock advertising on my Keir Starmer landlord hater video. So this is a BlackRock advert. Apparently people have been getting BlackRock adverts all day. This is another one that somebody sent me. So
BlackRock UK, if you're listening now, AA is willing to negotiate a sponsorship where you can have a 1 minute slot at the beginning.
Yeah, and there's a quick and easy way to do that through YouTube now as well. I can't remember what the option is.
You can sponsor YouTube manager me. Calls you up. I've got a great sponsorship opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, apparently they've streamlined the process. I'm like, okay, yeah, great. I've never had a sponsorship. Where are you, the country of Cuba? The country of Cuba should have been sponsoring me for about 4 years now. I should get a cigar sponsor, really. If you're a cigar manufacturer, you should be the number one sponsor on this.
I wonder if the Cubans would genuinely do it as well, you know.
Well, you know, they did do something genuinely helpful, because they said, do you know, for the past 6-7 years, you have had this option of your advertising turned off. Basically, like anybody who has an over 18 service, gambling, home remedies, anything that's like got an 18 plus mark on the advertising was filtered out by automatically, and you'd never find it in a million years if it wasn't pointed out to you. And since I've turned that on, you know, it does seem to have made some sort of difference, although the only advert I know that has played for sure has been BlackRock. So there we are. Sinbel Extra Tempest says Birak the Wise is marshalling the dog sire. O2Tom says, will Bastani become a Sith? I doubt it very much. I feel like he's never going to make the full turn. He's just going to stay where he is for a very long time. That's my sense with him. It's a little bit difficult when you're the owner of Navarra Media. So he's kind of got some natural constraints there too. I noticed, for example, do you remember when Ash Sakar went, "I'm literally a communist"? Do you remember that moment?
Yeah.
That video, has got 7.5 million views. Right. Ash Sakar is never leaving Navarra Media, and she's never leaving the "I'm literally a communist" gimmick. Right. Because that is her meal ticket for life.
Yeah.
As is it for Bastani. Right. And Bastani's never going to fire Ash Sakar for that either. Right. So it's like that, you know, they're kind of bound in a way to the moment of their fame, if that makes any sense. So he's never going to fully say, "Well, I'm not a leftist anymore," obviously. But I still think that he has done interesting things. He's had John Gray on a few times as well, who's a very interesting figure. Rollover 101 says, "Hi, AA. It is 1945 and you've just been elected Prime Minister of the UK. What steps do you take to preserve the British Empire?" Oh, in 1945, it's pretty tough because the country's bankrupt by Churchill. And I'm Clement Attlee. And a lot of the things they did in that moment, the social housing, setting up the NHS, the welfare system, was basically stuff that they felt obliged to do after sending hundreds of thousands of young men to their deaths. Two world wars, don't forget, by that point. And there was a growing feeling in the country that the ruling classes had to give something back, basically, which is why one of the reasons that he won so big in the first place. If they hadn't have done that, there was a genuine risk, and this is going to sound boomerish, but in the actual realities of the 1940s, that Britain could have gone communist. That the workers, the unions, who were heavily, let's just say, infiltrated is probably too strong a word, but propagandized by the Soviets, by the Russians at that time. You know, there's a genuine risk of Britain being lost into the Soviet sphere, right?
Well, there was a lot of penetration by communist agents. It's like the Cambridge 10. Do you hear about those guys?
And
they were kind of they were doctoring stuff. They managed to lie about the situation in Yugoslav so well that they got Churchill to support Tito over the monarchists there. So they got him to literally to send cash and guns to communists to quote unquote liberate Yugoslavia. So yeah, it was very infiltrated, I think, by that time. So
I mean, it's a difficult thing because I mean, one of the things about Major General Richard Hilton is that in the Imperial Obituary, another one of his books, he's like, "Look, we could have made different choices. When there were all these kind of uprisings of various natives or whatever, get the gunboats back out. You know, we still have the power." So there were voices at that time. And don't forget, Britain still had big assets and armies all around the world in 1945. That is even before India became independent, right? They were spending money on it because and we were losing money hand over fist on that. But there was an attitude that those assets could have been maintained in such a way that could have started making money again. You could have actually just turned it around. So you would have had to abandon free trade, you know, with the entire world, but reimposed free trade within the empire, if that makes any sense. So you kind of have a tariff boundary around all the things you control, and then try to make a comeback of, you know, the old raw materials from the colony, manufacture it back in Britain, sell it back out to the colony, you know, that kind of extractive colonialism. You could have tried to keep that going in a way. The trouble is that both the Russians and the Americans were hell-bent against that.
You got to understand that FDR several times said he wanted India liberated specifically and empire dismantled. And, you know, you know, we've got the Color Revolution and Niger video yes. this week. Just imagine color revolutions being instigated by the Americans across empire for the next 10 years. It's untenable. I think the only way you could have done it is to literally just go back to, I would have literally liberated all non-Anglo parts of the empire. So you keep Canada, Australia, New Zealand, maybe South Africa, or like maybe like a slim, like a cape like South Africa, and then turtled from there. I think that's the only way you could have done it, because anywhere where there was like an outgroup, they would have just color revolutioned even harder than they did. So
it's kind of interesting because Hilton has this idea that in the 50s Britain still had enough about it to be able to stand up, which sounds ridiculous now, right? But remember, before you lose all those territory, there's still quite a lot of combined assets all together, right? So his idea was basically like erect tariff boundaries around what you already control. India's already been lost by that point. And then basically let the Americans know in no uncertain terms that if they cross certain red lines, it would be a war, right? And basically like the Americans are not going to declare war on Britain, basically, right? I mean, if you can imagine a war between Britain and America, let's say in 1962, with Russia on the map as well. So his whole idea is that
that's true.
Britain was strong enough still at that moment to kind of play the two great powers off against each other. I mean, there's still like a fifth of the world under British control at that point. And then use all your various diplomatic strength and then play it hard and call their bluffs whenever possible and basically resist what he calls the dollar system, right? And bring the pound back online for those parts of the world that are still under your control and prevent dollar hegemony from getting going. Remember, he's writing in the 50s. But in 1945, if you had all that hindsight and you did it from the very moment, you could have played it hard. The trouble is that fat pig twat Churchill had already signed us up to Marshall Plan. He'd already got us into various debts that we owed the Americans. He'd already given up control of various bases and, you know, land lease and all of that. So you're already like, you have to try to undo all of that, but you could either go hard, like Hilton suggested, or like Farrow said, you have to give it all up and turtle and play some sort of rear guard action while resisting American encroachment, which was significant, by the way. And that's something else Bastani's been pretty good on since these books have come out, Vassal State and the other one I mentioned the other day. But it was possible. I reckon it was possible, but it would have taken real boldness. And I don't know if it could have been achieved while also doing all the stuff that Attlee did do, which was NHS, social housing. What was the other thing? I mean, he nationalized oil and coal and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, you may have had to, like, it may be the case that in 1945, if you didn't do that sort of stuff, there'd have been some sort of socialist revolution, which sounds boomery now, but I do think was a genuine risk in 1945. Mm. So it's tricky. It's a needle to thread, but, you know, other things could have been done. Rollover 101 says, did Blair sabotage England because he's Scottish? I don't know about that. I don't really think that questions like nationality really come into Blair's thinking in that sort of way. They do remain committed to devolution, though, for reasons that I don't quite understand, because if anything's been an absolute disaster, it's been that. But from Blair's point of view, devolution was a way of creating further nodes of control, little bureaucracies, little kind of bits that are how can you say, they've got stickability, they're difficult to budge once they get going. And I mean, look at the absolute cancer of the Welsh Assembly or the Scottish Parliament or the Manchester Mayor and all this sort of stuff. Like, I mean, all of these have been power centres for Labour. So from that point of view, it makes sense. But I don't think that the fact that he's Scottish plays into it, really. John Lister says, money for my favourite daytime show, Office Hours. Well, thank you very much, John Lister. I'm glad it's somebody's favourite show after only 2 weeks. So Broman Hanks says, hey, AA, I like the new logo. Well, I'm glad somebody likes the new logo because plenty of people don't. Will you be making a video on Sudan? But you will learn to love it. We need to get the relationship between the channel owner and the audience right. Is that how Tony Blair would put it? hey, I like the new logo. Will you be making a video on Sudan? I'm curious why the MSM and establishment don't seem to care. Well, I was thinking of touching on a number of hot spots for in that Thursday slot. I want to make something on Yemen. Sudan is a nice call. I'm kind of interested in the idea of the hidden conflict in that part of the world between revolutionary Islam and these kind of corrupt crown princes that are basically American proxies that are propped up in the region. So there's plenty of things like that. But yeah, the trouble is with those Thursday videos, they take a bit of extra research by me versus some of the others. Yeah, I will have a look. I'm looking at all of those things and I will do something soon. Probably the week after next week is the Justin Trudeau one. The week after next, I'm thinking of probably doing something on what's happening in Israel because it's a little bit overdue and things are escalating there. So once I find out a bit more about what's happening, I want to try to get something out on that. But once that is done, I am quite open to looking at places like Sudan, Yemen. There's various other conflicts as well that I'm interested in. Redacted says, can we look forward to a 2024 Christmas ad review? Farah, what do you reckon? Should we keep the tradition going?
We'll see. If we get 1,000 likes, I don't know, yeah. Always.
Sergeant Hoddle says, what's the deal with the gay justice systems giving ridiculously slow sentences for killing, messing with kids, and rape? You'd think physically attacking mostly sacred sisterhood would be a high crime. What does the global American empire gain from this? Well, this is just the American, not the American, this is just the anarcho-tyranny that Sam Francis talked about. And this was also a feature of the Soviet Union. If some account, they punish political crimes more harshly than they punish actual crimes. I always remember reading an interview with Anthony Burgess on Clockwork Orange, that his inspiration for Clockwork Orange was that, basically, that normal crimes are not that harshly punished in the Soviet Union, that they only care about the thought crimes, you know? I fear that it's just that, it's just anarcho-tyranny. What, I mean, why they do it is harder to answer. It's just where their priorities really are in, you know, it's just naked power again, you know, friend, enemy, you know, watching, taking out the rival castles, all the stuff I usually talk about. But unfortunately, when it comes to the crime, you know, they don't really care about the human cost. They don't give a shit. They don't care about victims or violence or people who've been killed or kids or anything. They literally don't. And I wish that my assessment of them could be more charitable. But I'm at the point, Farah, where I really don't believe they care at all about those basic elements of classic governance. Which is why possibly why they aren't listening to Tone more, because Tone is, with his superior understanding of power, he understands that basically any power system at the end of the day is judged on its ability to fulfill those, you know, internal and external enemies, right? I mean, any king, any government, that's the contract. Carl Schmitt talks about it. De Maistre talks about it. That is the fundamental contract between the ruler and the people. You keep us safe, keep crime low, and if there are foreign invaders, you get the army and you repel them. Bob's your uncle. That's your part of it done. They basically fail that part. In fact, there's no part of the classic expectations of government that they do fulfill at this time. That should be the end. That should be the end of any ruling class. Maybe we're seeing the death throes of them, but we'll see. But Pharaoh.
No, all I was saying, this sort of goes back to what I was saying about them being Blair's Gollum or whatever. That they've taken on several of the several of those core messages that he said from his leadership book. But I think you can get away with this stuff to a degree. I think what's happened is they've had a taste of basically ignoring the population, ignoring what people have to say, and they're like, okay, yeah, actually we can get away with this. You know, we don't have to step down, we don't have to quit. Like I say, I think this Grey Woman is interesting in terms of as a bellwether, whether like they're kind of going to be firmly on this path or they're going to be reined in. If she doesn't get sacked, I genuinely think they're just going to be like, well, we don't care, we can do whatever the hell we like. We've got another 4 years. But you know, there was stuff like like a Labour MP being kicked out of a pub, etc. I think you'll get to a point where you're universally hated so much that people will literally just like attack you on the street kind of levels. I think that's within the realm of possibility.
I mean, he's saying he can't go to a football match now, isn't he, Keir Starmer?
Well, this is the thing, and it's like, but then what I think they'll do is they'll put in more rules to protect themselves from those situations, which will then exacerbate it further. I think you just end up in some kind of doom loop at a certain point where the people fundamentally hate you so much, you're not able to actually do government itself. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you get like a general strike or something like that, and then this is what I'm saying. My biggest concern for the country is entering a state of anarchy, where there's kind of like some kind of status, there is still a non-zero chance of that happening with the current government and someone like Tome not stepping in or not sorting it out quickly, because I think they feel immovable right now in terms of they're on a certain path and they're not changing and they're not bending. So what happens, you know, what happens when the immovable object hits the unstoppable force or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is that there's quite a lot of slack. I mean, for example, in Egypt, right, the government is so hated that they've had to move the entire capital from Cairo town center, yeah, right, to they're just building a new city miles away in the middle of the desert that nobody can get to, because Egypt has had this problem of people just rioting right where the government is in the middle of Cairo, right? Blocking up all the streets and so on. So their new plan is, well, if we just put the capital over there where the people cannot reach us, then we'll be safe, right? Now, I don't know whether that option exists in the UK, but that, I mean, what I'm saying is that's how far gone things can get in a country with a government still maintaining power. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, I think two things. Number one, they have a powerful, not a powerful military, but an active military. Number two, we have a much more complicated, like, we're like an intricate clock. And I genuinely think that, again, if you saw like the farmers in the Netherlands or whatever, I really do not think it would take that much to grind down society and to stop. Because everything is so interdependent and everything is so complicated. And thirdly, we're a much smaller country. There's sort of nowhere to go. There's like, I mean, that was one thing I was thinking was maybe this is literally why they're bringing in so many people, is to, again, to create a class of people that is sort of relying on their patronage that they can then protect themselves with, you know. But maybe that's too much.
Keir Starmer, the first prime minister to rule from the Isle of Wight, or the Isle, well, exactly. Commandeer the Isle of Man or something, you know.
Yeah, he's sort of building up a new, because you know that all the Janissaries in the Ottomans were foreigners, weren't they? The foreign children they stole. It's kind of, I wonder whether he's trying to create like a Janissarial style army of migrants.
Well, that's what they're doing everywhere, though. That's what the Democrats are doing in America as well. I mean, that's the plan. What could go wrong? Double Dime says, can't watch live, need to go to bed. Good luck with the new direction. All the best from America. Now get out. Going to bed at this time, I mean, that isn't it the morning in America? That means that Double Dime has been up all night and is only now going to bed. But he could do shift work. So let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Thank you very much, Double Dime. Cow Cud says, thoughts on Undertaker versus Mankind, Hell in a Cell? I just got through your Ric Flair videos. They were amazing. 10 out of 10. Also, it's Cow Cud is a twin. Okay, Cow Cud is a twin. Yeah, I mean, I'm not really that big on stuff like Hell in a Cell, like that later Attitude Era stuff in general. My interests lie elsewhere, I'll just put it that way. But I remember it at the time. I remember that match happening, and it was amazing to watch live. I wasn't there. I watched it on TV, and it was marked out and all the rest of it. So, Spasticus Autisticus says, rich tea packaging is awful. You pay for biscuits, but open a pack of crumbs. If you find a whole biscuit, it'll have a hairline crack that'll break when dunked. A betrayal Judas and Brutus would blush at. Would a cardboard box really be too hard? What he's moaning about here, Pharaoh, is that little blue pack that rich tea biscuits come in. It's just a flimsy bit of plastic, really.
Yeah.
And they do get broken quite a lot. He's right about that. Dan, qua 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 111, says, also, the mainstream history is written that unconditional surrender was necessary because Versailles was not strong enough to prevent the mid-century Germans, as if that's the start and end of that. So there we are. That is the reason given for the unconditional surrender, Pharaoh, because Versailles was not hard enough on the Germans. It needs to be...
This is what I'm saying. It's genuinely a psychotic approach to life. You know, at no other time in any battles, even the most savage of cavemen, of Bronze Age invaders, wouldn't have the same kind of psychotic terms. And like I said, it's perfectly good saying this when you're the victor. But I'm telling you, one day I'm certain of it, we will engage with a foe that will do the same kind of victory conditions that we did to the Germans, and we will rue the day of ever conceiving of that concept.
Utvara 1 says, I am a Slav and I'm happy that Churchill helped us. Meanwhile, someone familiar with the cycle of empires must know that the British one was old and on its way out anyway. How did Churchill help you as a Slav?
Well, it depends which kind of Slav. Brought in Tito, I guess he's... Tito was like one of the better... rulers, if I'm honest with you, you know, you tried to play both sides off each other, you know. But
is he happy for like communist rule essentially?
Well, that's it. Literally, the thing is that we literally had like the king of Yugoslav like living in Britain at the time, and then he found out that like the British government had sort of double crossed him and said, oh, we're actually going to help the communists instead. All because of these faked victories, etc. We were helping the Yugoslavs out no matter what. It was just that we decided to abandon the traditional political form for the form that hated us, the form that wanted to dismantle what we are and destroy our way of life. That's who we chose to help out.
TP says, in Australia, our mass immigration is Indian and Chinese. Not the savages Europe is being served. The Chinese are being bankrolled in buying property. Well, there were a lot of Indians here too, and a lot of Chinese here too, but not as many Chinese, but there are quite a lot of Indians. And I mean, this is still an issue, though, that I've talked about before. I think there's possibly too much focus on the quality of the particular immigrant population, that the stronger view is it doesn't really matter what type of immigrant it is. You just don't want them. High IQ, low IQ, civilized or not. You just don't want them because they're not of your people and they will take over in time. The Indians and the Chinese are two of the, I mean, the Chinese have often been called, let's just say, the middleman populations of the Far East. I'll just put it that way. They're a middleman population, much like another, you know, much like those people from the Middle East are often being middlemen throughout history. The Chinese in other nations, when they're outside of China, have a habit of taking over the local economy and buying up all the property and things like that. So you don't want the Chinese there because they're going to do that. Same as the Indians. The Indians have a network. You know, I've talked before about, you know, why are all the corner stores owned by these people? Is it because British people don't want to run shops? Or is it because they've got the control over the supply list and, you know, they do mates deals or things like that, right? There are all sorts of ways and means that these people use their natural ethnocentric ways to game a system that seems fair on its face. When everybody else is playing individualist, they're playing tribe. So you always want to avoid any people coming in, I would say, regardless of where they're from, whether they're clever and civilized or not. Zong Sheena says, how can a leader who is pissed 24/7 be effective? He's talking about Churchill, of course, Pharaoh. TP says, WEF clarification for Pharaoh. It is a world government run by a certain people, certain group, you know, the ones. War on Europeans is a policy being implemented by golems like Starmer. I'm not entirely sure about that. Pharaoh has to go in a moment. Mulatto Ultra says, Curtis posits conspiracy theories are an attempt to re-enchant the managerial world. What additional insight would you provide to this statement? And this is the last question, Pharaoh. Conspiracy theories are an attempt to re-enchant the managerial world.
If by re-enchant he means to give it back power, again, Curtis actually sort of talks about the origins of conspiracy. You know, the first kind of conspiracy theory put in Playboy magazine. I think this is in Hypernormalization, where and it was purposely put in there by the CIA to kind of fool people. So I think that kind of regime, the regime has been able to use it for a long time to kind of disrupt things, and I think it sends people a little bit mad. This is what I'm saying about being conspiracy brained, but I think that certainly in the age of social media, where data is freer, and especially with Musk's regime, even with all of its problems, I think that conspiracy theories, or the understanding of conspiracy, I should say, is a net negative for the regime. You know, it's working against them because more stuff is being exposed than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, I think conspiracy stuff also goes hand in hand sometimes with a certain degree of occultism and knowledge of esoteric topics and things like that. So in a strange way, it can lead to a kind of re-enchantment or a kind of spiritual awakening. I mean, I've noticed that people who get into conspiracy stuff often also become like a weird type of Christian, I've noticed. Delingpole became a Christian, as an example. So those two things often go hand in hand. So, yeah, maybe he's right about that. Okay, Pharaoh, just before we get out of here, where can people find you, sir?
Just on Twitter and on my YouTube channel. I've been doing a few streams recently. I interviewed a guy called SD Wicket on his new book. Simon Roberts and I went to the theatre in London to kind of hate review a terrible woke play. So check that out. That was quite fun. And yes, I've kind of launched my new screen print. So take a look at that. And yes, by Foundations of Entrepreneurship.
Yes, and I co-sign all of that. Other great courses are available. I will be back tomorrow with Simon Roberts, possibly Horace too, with more Adam Curtis. I have forgotten which one, though, because we have finished. Is it the trap next? I'm trying to remember where we are. It is The Power of Nightmares, The Power of Nightmares. The parallel between the rise of Islamism in the Arab world and neoconservatism in the USA to create the myth of a dangerous enemy to gain support. So that is Adam Curtis's BAFTA-winning series, The Power of Nightmares. It will be very interesting to revisit that in current year. Also, video short at 8 a.m., video at 9 a.m. Tomorrow's video is Haitians eating dogs, Trump's mistake, ? And if you know anything about the rules of writing headlines, you already know the answer to that question. Now get out, everybody.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.